The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. As an interactive call-in show, we obviously take a special pleasure in audience participation. So we'd like to take some time to talk a bit about the ways that you've figured out to interact with each other and with science. On today's episode, we'll be taking a look at the increasing focus on community-driven science and skeptical conferences. Science Online organizer Boro Zivkovic will be online to talk about the evolution of that conference and his experience putting together a massive, multi-day interactive gathering of scientists and science enthusiasts. And to start us off on the topic, the founder of the Skepticamp conference model is on hand for a little speaking up. We're here today with Reed Esau, software architect and skeptical activist. Reed has been one of the driving forces behind the Denver Skeptics, and he's published articles in the Skeptical Inquirer and in Swift, the blog of the James Randi Educational Foundation. And in 2007, he helped to create the Open Skeptic Conference format known as Skepticamp. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Reed.
Hello, Desiree. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for being on the show.
Glad to be here.
So Skepticamp is an example of what's called an open conference format. So what does that mean?
Well, the idea of an open conference is pretty interesting because you can... It's probably best understood by comparing it to the traditional conferences that are wouldn't be as open, or they'd be closed. And the idea behind an open conference is you try to tear down some of the barriers that would ordinarily either prevent the conference from happening, let's say in a small market, or you want to tear down barriers to get people to participate more. And so for an open conference like the Skepticamps, which are focused on topics related to science and skepticism and critical thinking, we want people to participate either by helping to organize the conference or ideally by coming and doing a talk at the conference. And this is an invitation that we extend to pretty much anyone.
So it's kind of like a wiki conference, correct?
A wiki is a collaborative tool, and open conferences are very collaborative as well. And so, yeah, a wiki would describe it very well.
So, did you have a lot of experience with open conferences before you created Skepticamp?
I work in the tech industry where open conferences and user groups are very common. I had some experience, but I wasn't a regular bar camp attendee, although I had attended a number of user group meetings, and so I had some idea of what they were trying to get at. And I'd been to some larger conferences as well that had some open content, like a big open space room where people would come and do presentations, and this would be alongside the normal traditional content of the conference. And so this basically was my experience leading into Skepticamp and getting active as a skeptic.
So what prompted you to think that the open conference model would be better for the skeptical community than something like the typical lecturer sits in front of room, other people ask respectful questions at the opportune times?
Well, I think both models, the open model and the traditional model, both have a lot to offer, and both can reach out in different ways. The open model is nice because if you look at the example of the conference format that Skepticamp is based on, it's called BarCamp, and this is what's in the tech community. The reach of BarCamp has which started in less than 5 years ago, I think it is. The reach of it has been amazing. They've had probably upwards of 500 conferences around the world, and this is around the world. This is on nearly every continent. And in fact, I think probably a good 10 to 15% of the bar camps happen in India, where a traditional conference wouldn't reach. And so you have the ability to reach into the smaller markets and into the foreign markets that with an open conference that a traditional conference might otherwise ignore.
So what was the initial feedback the first time you ran this?
Well, the initial feedback, when we did our first event, which was, I was just like 6 months into helping to organize the new Denver Skeptical Meetup Group, and we were just basically having fun with the experiment and not really sure if it would be a good fit or not. Everything turned out amazingly well for our first event. I think we had 11 talks, and we filled up a whole day, and I think we had somewhere between 30, 35 people attending. And so, and then the feedback was, very well, but at the same time, we learned a lot. We learned a lot of things that we would not do again, just various mistakes that we had made.
And did some of those mistakes go into the Skeptic Wiki that you've set up?
Yes, thank you for mentioning the website, Jesse. I set up a wiki to gather up all the accumulated knowledge from all the organizers of these events, because the last thing you want to do when you organize an event is to make a mistake that other people have already made. We want to try to learn from the things that other people did that either was succeeded or that failed, so that we can improve these events over time. And the Skeptic Camp Wiki is our principal tool for sharing that information.
Absolutely. Well, it must have been successful, because people are running with this format. How many skeptical conferences do you know have adopted this format?
Let's see. Well, there have been 11 events so far that follow this model. Not all of them have been called Skeptic Camp, but it's basically based on the open model where the focus is on the science, the skepticism, and the critical thinking.
Right.
And those events have been most of the events have been here in the United States, but Vancouver in your country they've already had two events, and they're coming up on their third event next month. Edinburgh, Scotland, has had one as well.
That's fantastic. So, do you have people beating down your door for advice on how to run one, or is that really why you created the wiki?
I will typically be sending people to the wiki, but they're ultimately people don't have to come to me to find out how to organize that one, because I've only really organized the very first one. My role has been to try to get other people to organize them, because that's ultimately the more people that we have doing it, the more we learn about how to put these things together. Because we're not professional organizers, we basically have to work together and figure out how to best pull these off.
Right.
And so I will, when somebody has a question, I'll try to push them towards the other organizers who may have dealt with that firsthand, rather than deal with my secondhand information.
Well, tell us about some of the success stories.
One of the big success stories was last February, about a year ago, in Atlanta. They had their very first event, and they not only had a really strong turnout, but they did gangbusters on finding sponsors. They had I think upwards of like 17, 20 talks, which was more than we ever approached in Colorado. And also they had two podcasting crews there who covered the event, as well as they did a live video and audio feed. So many people like myself from around the country and around the world were tuning in to watch the talks and to interact with all the attendees via Twitter. And that's something that we haven't done anything like that in Colorado. So that was one of that gave us a taste of what's possible with these events. And so that would be a good example of one of the big steps up.
So the organizers are really taking this model and modifying it very creatively in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's I never want to give the idea that, that there's only one way to do these things. Everybody's going to be coming to it with their own experience, their own ideas on just on where to take it. And so as long as they adhere to those the very basic principles of the event, that is keeping it open, as low cost and fun, they're free to experiment.
So do you know of any, I'm just wondering, do you know of any conferences that started with a more traditional model and then they transitioned to the open format?
Let's see. The tech community, I know that there's a long history of experimenting with a lot of different conference formats. I wouldn't be surprised if some of them went that direction, but I don't know offhand if anyone's done that.
Interesting. So are there any downfalls to this? Is there anything a more conventional conference is better for?
I'd say there have been some bar camps being the tech-oriented version of Skeptic Camp, that have scaled amazingly well. There's a bar camp in Minneapolis every year that scales to like 400 people or more. And that's with an open conference format. It may not be pure bar camp. It's probably more of a hybrid, like that science online. But nevertheless, it's shown the ability to scale quite a bit. However, it's not clear just how well the open conferences will scale. I think it's a little bit too early in the cycle. In a traditional conference, on the other hand, they typically have a lot of money and resources that they can scale a lot better,
right,
to larger markets.
Well, are you familiar with the Science Online model?
I've read some about it, and I know they started out with a bar camp type format, and they transitioned to a hybrid model, which I think is just fine. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the skeptic camps had that direction.
That's what I was actually going to ask. Do you see that as sort of being the natural evolution?
We are
going to be talking to Bora Zivkovic later on in the show.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Ultimately, I think that what we want to do is we want to do whatever we can to tear down the barriers to having events where otherwise we would have none or very few. And whether that means we're going to have a hybrid model or a totally open model, for whatever markets, some markets may want one or the other, I'd say we should experiment and explore and see what's possible.
So the goal, definitely one of the major goals of Skeptic Camp, is inclusivity, and it is participation. But some people don't want to do any work, my friend. This model is very reliant on community participation. So how many people would need to be involved to really make a Skeptic Camp work, would you say?
Well, some of the events started out small. I think Vancouver started with like 15 people and like 5 talks or something like that. And I think that's just fine for a first event. You don't have to start out like Chicago will a week from this weekend, I think it is. They're going to start out probably their very first event, 80 people, and it's a whole day full of talks. That's going to be a fairly high-powered event as far as the skeptic camps go. And that's, I'd say, is atypical and more geared towards a large market like Chicago.
Right.
I'd say most of the events are going to start out small, and these are meant to be informal events that you can put together very easily and very much on the cheap. And so I'd say there's really no low threshold for to have a Skeptic Camp event. It's just a matter of getting people together and sharing that knowledge, which is the big goal of the whole effort.
So would you say that you don't actually have to be an expert to be involved in Skeptic Camp?
Yeah, that's right. These are I'm an amateur. When we started these out, we were all amateurs. I think one of the fellow organizers at our first event had some experience organizing events, but nothing like a bar camp or skeptic camp. And so it was all very new to us. And so we were just wandering through the dark, and I take that back. We weren't wandering through the dark because we had all the experiences of the bar camps to build upon, right. So we had some idea what to expect. You don't have to be an expert to organize them, and as far as doing a talk, we want to encourage a lot of first-time speakers, people that are new to skepticism, who have a certain passion for one topic or another that may not be directly related to skepticism, but maybe in something that's going to be of interest to skeptics. For example, one of my favorite examples would be the audio enthusiast, who's very much into the technology behind stereos and home theater. They can talk about all the snake oil in the industry and what the good values are and what the bad values are. And that's something that would be a perfect talk for a skeptic candidate.
Absolutely. Do you have any plans to try to more widely promote the use of the Skepticamp model among skeptical organizers? Because a lot of us do know what Skepticamp is, but I realize a lot of us don't.
That's right. We've been letting it grow organically over the past two and a half, three years. I forget what the numbers are. For the reason that we knew that we'd be trying to figure out a lot of this stuff. BarCamp has a lot of track record behind it. However, we're adapting BarCamp to the domain of contemporary skepticism, which is a little bit different of a community. And so we know that we'd have to overcome some of the challenges and figure out how to do things. And so we've just been slowly building up that knowledge base, and then and just relying on word of mouth for people to learn about it and to encourage others people in other cities to give it a shot.
So if somebody decides that they want to just do the research behind setting this up, where can they go? This is your opportunity to plug the wiki. I love the wiki. I was looking through it, and honestly, it's brilliant. It's every single thing you could possibly want to know about how to set this up yourself.
Yeah, I always say that the best resources just to get it to understand what Skepticamp is and how it works is to listen to the Skepticality episode that features a wrap up of the Atlanta event. And that gives a really good idea to the sort of talks you're going to listen to at the events. It samples a lot of them, and it gives you a good idea of what the energy is at these events, where people just getting together, just having fun, sharing knowledge, and just having a good time. But beyond that, the wiki is a good detailed resource that compiles a lot of the experience of myself and others in organizing these events. And as well, as good of a resource as any is to talk to the organizers of these events and ask them what happened, just to ask them about their experiences.
That's perfect. Thanks very much for being here, Reid.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Desiree.
And thank you for all the work you're doing. This is very beneficial to all of us.
I for one, am looking forward to hearing of a Skepticamp being announced in Alberta. It's either in Edmonton or Calgary. That would work.
Absolutely. And it's something that we've discussed. And now that I know that we only need 15 people for it, it's probably within our grasp.
It's just in getting your foot in the door is the important part. That's what Vancouver did. And they're building it up into what may become the dominant skeptical event in Western Canada.
You are an optimistic man, sir. We need more like you. You can find Reid blogging occasionally at esau.org, and you can find out all about the Skepticamp model and how to set one up yourself at skepticamp.org. And if you're doing something amazing out there, whether it's holding your own Skepticamp or other evidence-based event, or you have some interesting science or critical thinking-oriented topic to discuss, we are your forum of choice. tell us about it at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Just put speaking up in the subject line and we'll get back to you. And we'll be right back after these brief messages.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including
Citywide LP 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia. CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia. CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario. CLHI Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia. Freethought Radio and WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. And I'm here today with Bora Zivkovic. Bora started out studying birds' brains at North Carolina State University, and he's now the online community manager at the Public Library of Science, the open access publisher of scientific and biomedical literature. He blogs at A Blog Around the Clock on scienceblogs.com, teaches Bio 101 to non-traditional students at North Carolina Wesleyan College, and edits the annual anthology of the best writing on science blogs. He also organizes the annual Science Online Conference. Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, Bora.
Nice to be back, did you?
So you were actually on Speaking Up a couple of months ago before Science Online to promote the conference.
That's right.
For those audience members out there who haven't listened to the episode, could you just give us a brief background? What is the focus of Science Online?
Science Online is a conference that explores pretty much every way that science and web interact. So how scientists and others, educators, journalists, web designers, are using the web to promote science, to teach science, to do science.
So how long has the conference been happening now?
The January conference was our fourth annual conference, and yeah, it's quite a long time. It's evolved quite a lot. I'm sure you'll have questions about that, how in which direction it evolved over the 4 years and four incarnations of the meeting.
Absolutely. So what made you and those who helped found the conference decide that there needed to be a whole conference just about how to communicate science on the web?
That's a very good question. It started out with me attending some other conferences, a blogger con in Chapel Hill and a podcaster con in Chapel Hill, which kind of also in a mixed format, and then I just posted a blog post on my blog. Wouldn't it be cool to have something like this for science bloggers, which was already a growing community of bloggers, just get together and have a beer? Of course, there's no interest for sponsors or anybody to, you know, fly a bunch of people from around the world just to have beer. But Anton Zeiker, my friend here in the Triangle, said, hey, we can have a serious program and then sponsors will show up and we can definitely do this. So it was my idea, but it was really his energy and his belief that this can be done that resulted in the first conference. The first conference we wanted to start small. What we wanted is to make the conference local. Triangle area of North Carolina is a hub of science with several, you know, three big and several medium and small size research universities. So there's a lot of science going on, and there's a Research Triangle Park with all these companies with lots of scientists in them. At the same time, it's a big web and techie hub with a very long tradition in blogging and online work. So we wanted to bring those two communities locally together, you know, local bloggers and local scientists for a day of discussions. It did not work that way because even the first conference already had people who signed up, who registered and flew in from all around the country and from Canada, United Kingdom, a couple of other countries. And then it just grew from there.
So was there initially, there wasn't a lot of interaction between bloggers and scientists?
No, those were pretty separate worlds. This is a pretty big place, and everybody just goes, with their own business. So that was our attempt to learn from scientists for instance, web developers and programmers to learn from scientists what they need, and for scientists to see what are the potentials of the web for their work or their teaching or various other things that scientists want to do that they have always done in traditional ways through print or mass media or just scientific journals talking to each other, which also includes fights and struggles against various pseudoscience movements.
So the Speaking Up episode that we heard earlier was with Reed Esau, the gentleman who adapted the tech community's Barcamp model to the skeptical community. So would you say that you guys basically started out doing the same thing with science?
Yes, we did that. The first one was really a pure unconference. There's a Wikipedia page for unconference, which defines it. But there is a sort of two meanings of the word unconference. There is the kind of the meaning or the definition that Barcamp people and techies really like, and that is that the program is not not assigned in advance, is decided by the participants on the spot, like first thing in the morning. They're like a big whiteboard and everybody just jots down their names and say, let's talk about this. There is the other meaning of unconference that comes from Dave Weiner back in 2006, who said that the sum of the expertise of the people in the audience is greater than the sum of expertise of the people on stage, which is really a description of how sessions are going, so that you don't have somebody giving a lecture and others are nodding or taking notes, but it's really a conversation, a discussion. So for the first one, we took both of the definitions of unconference, and it worked great. But we decided to move away from it between the first and the second conference for a couple of reasons. First, I, in the meantime, attended Science Food Camp in Mountain View, and I saw both the pros and the cons of the pure unconference model. Second is that we were pretty unhappy with the diversity, especially the gender breakdown of the first conference, which was very typically techie male dominated, and we wanted to do something about it. And the third is, when we opened up the wiki for suggestions for the sessions for the next year, we realized that we are getting, again, the same topics as we did the first year. Some of the topics that were, let's say, very bloggy but not very sciencey, how to beat up on trolls. I mean, that's that doesn't have much to do with science. And everybody suggesting sessions were people like me, 40 white male alpha personality, which makes it very competitive, and it makes it uncomfortable for a lot of other people who are not part of that kind of, who are not 40 and white and alpha personality. So we decided that we needed to step in and modify the unconference format. So to leave the second meeting, that the sessions are going to be very interactive, but that we have to do something about the planning of the program. That doesn't mean that we were inviting people and paying them to fly in. We were reaching out to people we knew in the community, suggesting that they should look it up, think about it, volunteer a good topic. And that way we got a much better gender parity and age parity and race parity. And, you know, 4 years into the conference, that pays off. Now, this conference is known for being exactly like that. And this year we had 133 men and 134 women, about half and half of the moderators as far as gender. We had 10 people younger than 18 and 2 people older than 70 and everything in between, and also, you know, various, you know, ethnicities and races. So I think one has to work on getting the diversity, and the pure unconference format will not automatically bring it. It actually works in the other direction, favoring a particular type of aggressively competitive male.
So why do you think that is?
I don't know. If it's a, you know, self, it is a self-promotional kind of thing. So people who are good about self-promotion and happy about self-promotion, or have a reason to self-promote because it's their business, they're going to be the first ones to suggest sessions to lead. And everybody else is then left in the dust and is not going to even try. So you have to, as an organizer, make an effort and show that you're making an effort, and actually reach out to people who have different voices and who can bring different angles to the discussion. They're not going to suddenly come to the table where they have traditionally been excluded.
So I'm wondering now. I think there's an obvious benefit to the attendees, your focus on diversity, but do you think it has a benefit for science itself?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, science itself is pretty male-dominated. In some areas of science, it's not numerically, but when you look at the power structure of science, in every discipline, it's the men who are pulling the ropes. So it is the... I think it's good for science that and for our conference that it is so diverse, and that we are actively working on making it diverse. You come to our conference and you see, oh, this is how it could be in science, not just at this one particular conference.
Audience, if you have questions for Bora about science online, do give us a call. We're at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or by Twitter at Skeptical Radio. And we actually have a multi-part email question on the diversity topic.
Okay.
Do you feel that balancing gender and ethnicity at science and skepticism-based conferences, speakers and/or attendees, is a serious issue today? What should be expected, and is there a standard that conferences aspire to that is not well known? If effort to maintain balance is necessary, how can organizers avoid tokenism? And that question is from Barbara Drescher.
Well, we've just sort of already touched on that. I can probably add that what should be expected is, is their standard. I guess the standard should be roughly 50-50, and not every conference and not every year is going to be exactly 50-50. It's just fantastic that this year we did have exactly 50-50, which is, you know, nice numbers to show. It really, you know, if it's 50-50, and, you know, 10 are younger than 18, I don't think it's tokenism, because you didn't just, you know, invite one young person and one woman and one African-American.
Right.
It becomes organic after 4 years of organizing. It becomes organic. The word spreads that this is a conference that's comfortable for everybody. And then people who are not white males, middle age, are going to going to grow in numbers, and they're going to feel as part of it, just like everybody else, not just as, okay, we are an invited group that is supposed to sit in the corner to make us look good. They are real movers of the conference program and conference proceedings, and it becomes much more pleasant for everybody involved that way.
Well, you're definitely succeeding, because Science Online is the most participatory conference I've ever attended. Now let's I want to kind of explain to people what it's like there, because not only do you mix scientific experts with lay people on the panels themselves, but the panelists are actually there to facilitate conversation between the audience members as well. I attended a session where actually the audience spoke far more than the presenter did, and the audience went off in a completely different direction than the stated intent of the panel. So is that what you want, that kind of spontaneity?
Yes. When we have, every session has a title, a name of, but the name of the conference is not the title of the lecture. The name of the conference is topic for discussion for that hour. And so you can't have just one or two people discussing. You want to have 57 people discussing, or whatever is the number of chairs per room. So I want everybody to be part of it, and more the audience, more the room gets involved earlier on in the session, and more actively, the better. And if the whole room wants to move the discussion in a different direction, that's probably a good sign that should have been a topic in the first place. So we are very happy about it. There's always a couple of people who are new to unconferences who find it a little unsettling when something like that happens, but most people encourage us to not go back to lecturing and lots of PowerPoint, but to insist on doing this. And when you do a conference 4 years in a row and you have repeat offenders, people who come back over and over again, they set the tone, because they hit the ground running. They know how it works, and then kind of pull along with them the newbies.
Well, there are so many different kinds of panels. I almost think that this feels like a really big teach-in as opposed to a conference.
Mm-hmm. And a teaching, but it's an interesting form of a teaching, because everybody teaches and everybody learns. Mm-hmm. There's no division between teachers and students, which is something that's also very positive and very pleasant, because you have I think you tried to ask me last time I was here who are going to be the big stars, and I refused to answer, because everybody who comes to Science Online is a star, because everybody is really, really good at some aspect of this, and has come to Science Online to share that and to learn a lot of other things for which others are experts. So everybody is bringing expertise in some domain, and everybody is there open to learning about everything else. So there's no real star, and everybody is a star. I mean, if you ask people who were there, who are the big stars of the conference, you'll probably hear that those are Stacey Baker students, 8 high school students who presented on Sunday, who are absolutely amazing. They stole the show. They are not big stars in a traditional way that they have, you know, published 7 books and, you know, or have 3 PhDs and a Nobel Prize, but they were the stars of the show.
So do you think that it's better suited for the topics covered by Science Online, this model, than it might be for other conferences? Or do you think this is something that all conferences should be like?
I hope more conferences go in this direction to some extent. Not every conference is suited for this model. I'm thinking of just a traditional science conference in which, you know, ophthalmologists get together to exchange data. You kind of have to give the scientists the, you know, 20 minutes or 12 minutes or 50 minutes or whatever is allocated to show the data, and then have a question and answer after. It would be very, I think, disruptive to essentially the story they are telling. Speaking of stories, you know, having meetings where people tell stories, you don't want to interrupt them because the story has to have a flow. Business-oriented conferences are probably also not perfectly suited for this if somebody's showing off what their company is doing. So not everything is, but these kinds of things are. Techie education conferences, science conferences, and then, you know, even Science Online had several different kinds of sessions. Everybody's focused on the main sessions, which are in this very unconference-y format, but we had 15-minute demos where somebody just shows and tells their stuff. There's not a chance for too much discussion there. We had Ignite evening, where people had those rapid-fire 5-minute talks. That's also not a kind of a two-way discussion. That's also a presentation. We had workshops where the person in front did actually have more expertise than the rest of the audience in the room, who came with the expectation that they are going to learn a skill from somebody who possesses that skill. So even Science Online has several different aspects and several different formats of the sessions and what's going on, and some of those require one too many. But the bulk of the conference are these very participatory sessions.
Well, I was wondering, when you go to recruit presenters for Science Online, and it is for a very participatory workshop, are there people who are uncomfortable with that format?
Presenters usually are not. They may be nervous in advance of it. They wouldn't know how to do it. Again, it's nice having a conference 4 years in a row, because what we often do is ask people who have done it before to bring in brand new people. And that also prevents us from being very incestuous in a way, having always the same people showing up and doing the same things over and over and over again. We want to be open. So a lot of people who, for instance, moderated or sessions this year were co-moderators together with somebody who's done it before, which is a good way of essentially training new people for next year and next year and next year, and always bringing in new. Some people I directly contacted kind of out of the blue to bring people who are going to be completely fresh blood, completely outside of our narrow circle, who I thought would bring an interesting set of experiences and interesting pieces of knowledge. It's just, you know, a lot of emails back and forth explaining exactly how the format is going to go, and they did wonderfully.
So adding more people, because you've had more people every single year that you've had Science Online, correct?
Yeah, yes. So we've doubled over the 4 years. We started with 130, and then 170, 210, and about 270 this year.
So do you plan to increase that again next year? And if so, how are you going to keep that feeling of intimacy? Because even though there were how many hundreds of people there this year, it felt like a very intimate gathering.
That's not easy, and we've already had several meetings about organization of 2011 meeting. We want to increase the size because it is really unpleasant saying no to 130-something people on the waiting list. And we are trying to figure out if we're right now, early on, if we're going to have sufficient financial support from the sponsors that we can afford a larger space, which can accommodate more people. With more people, in order to make sure that the atmosphere, thinking actually the scheduling and how the whole program is organized, because there are a lot of kind of events that are part of the Science Online that are really meant for schmoozing and networking and just having fun, but they're kind of separated. They're Thursday night, they're Friday, and a lot of people don't realize, hey, that's an integral part of the conference. So they show up on Saturday morning and then later say, well, we missed on all the communal stuff. Right. It was there. So mixing those things up a little bit, breaking it up in smaller chunks, kind of layering serious stuff and less serious stuff, then everybody understands, okay, this is really a three-day conference, and there are all sorts of different things. And we were supposed to be there all the time and use all the opportunities to informally chat with other people and meet other people, and you know, just keep learning and keep teaching in various formal and informal ways. We're still designing that. We're still thinking about it, but it's definitely going to be a little bit different format in order to preserve that sense of community and intimacy.
And how many days did you sell out in this year?
Well, we on purpose opened up on Friday night. We got the moderators registered on Friday morning, Friday noon, and then send a message on Friday night to slow it down, because not so many people are online on over the weekend. Because we expected it was going to be fast, we had to quickly shut down the registration form on Monday morning because we were already over. We wanted to cap at 250. We ended up with about 270 people. So in 2 days.
2 days. Yes,
and it was weekend. It was weekend. If we opened up on Tuesday, it would have probably been closed in 6 hours.
We have a question from Reed, who was on Speaking Up today.
All right.
He's in the chat room, and he's asking, how do you find sponsors?
By speaking on the radio? Well, a lot of it is really asking people in our community, do you know anybody, or will your company be happy to do this? But it's also a gradual thing, something that you build over the years. So some sponsor who decides to do very little 1 year, just kind of to test the waters, usually comes out on the other end very excited and promises a much bigger support for the next year. So we are kind of building our group of sponsors. If you look at our homepage to see who the sponsors were, they're really coming from various different kinds of, you know, industries, different kinds of organizations and companies, from Invitrogen to Crossref to Nescent to North Carolina Biotechnology Center, Sigma Xi's host, Research Triangle Foundation was a big help this year. They run the Research Triangle Park. Google SideWiki this year was new. So industry, techie companies, vendors of laboratory equipment, developers, I guess we would draw the line at something like companies that produce weapons, tobacco, and porn. Right. But for the others, we'll evaluate on a case-by-case basis.
Well, have there been any issues? Did anybody not want to take sponsorships? Because those definitely could possibly come with their own set of problems.
We asked sponsors and they declined to do it, or vice versa?
The organizers themselves. Did anybody think that having the conference sponsored would be a bad idea, or potentially a bad idea? Because then you're beholden in a certain way to sponsors.
So far, we didn't have that problem because sponsors, when we contact sponsors, it's usually to sponsor a particular aspect of the conference, right, a launch or something like that. And sponsors really don't have any say on how the conference is organized and run. So, you know, in return, they get a lot of exposure because there's you know, a lot of eyes on the conference while it's lasting and after. But I think it's always a positive for the sponsors, and it's positive for us because we can afford really nice food. And
the food was fantastic.
And you know, every year we can afford more stuff. For instance, this year, knowing that everybody's on Twitter, we hired SignalShare. SignalShare is a company that provided Wi-Fi for Super Bowl, and they did it for us, a tiny little event, because we are neighbors. They're here in Raleigh, and they are pretty amazed, but everybody else was pretty amazed. Hey, we are at a conference and Wi-Fi works, which is kind of
refreshing.
Rarity. But they are really, the SignalShare guys were really stunned at the atmosphere because they were there. So they came into the rooms and watched the sessions. But they are also stunned that we moved 25 gigabytes of data in a day and a half. That we, during the conference, had almost 7,000 tweets. Now it's over 8,000 tweets because a month later people are still using the hashtag, which is also something that tells you about a conference that it has such a longevity. People are still blogging and tweeting about it a month later. It's not over. So people are remaining as an online community, waiting patiently until the next time we can actually meet in person.
Audience, this is your last chance to ask an email question, either that or in the chat room. Our email address is live@skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with those audience questions right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, biologist John Loxon joins us to discuss the genetic and evolutionary aspects of sexual reproduction. Why do some creatures reproduce sexually while others don't? And who's having more fun passing on their genes? On Speaking Up, action skeptic blogger Don Reifler joins us to discuss his plans for skeptical-themed content at this year's Gen Con gaming convention. Sex, Genes, and Evolution, next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Bora Zipkovic, one of the organizers of Science Online, the most interactive science conference in the world. I actually have no idea if that's true. Do you think that's true?
One of, let's say. I'm assuming there are some others, but we definitely have built a reputation, and I'm not going to disabuse you of this.
Wonderful. So we have a website question.
The scientific method is the basis of skepticism, and therefore it is logical that we would need a firm grounding in current science to be good skeptics. Do many non-scientists who identify as skeptics attend Science Online and other science conferences? If not, why do you think that is?
I think they do. I would say that there is a decent percentage of people who are who come to Science Online who are not scientists in any official sense, as far as not having degrees in science, not being scientists, being let's say web developers or writers who had who had English degrees and or finished journalism schools and somehow stumbled onto becoming science journalists. And I think skepticism, or you know, just being realistic and being empirical, is something that is a commonality to everybody who comes to Science Online. I don't think people who are I don't think pseudoscientists will be very much attracted to coming to our conference, I hope. But if they do, they'll be, you know, welcome. We are very open. Their stands would be probably strongly challenged.
So do you think you should be recruiting specifically within the skeptical community?
There is, of course, when you're an organizer and you have a particular amount of room and a number of people, you want to kind of have a nice breakdown of different kinds of people. So skeptical community has always been a part of Science Online all 4 years. And as the conference is growing, each of the segments of the conference is growing, but not evenly. For instance, last year, the big deal was open access publishing, and there was a lot of people who are heavily invested in this, who are interested in the new models of scientific publishing. This has kind of settled. The big problems that we feel are kind of not solved, but we now know how to solve them, and we're working on it. This year was the year of the kind of breakdown of journalism in general, not just science journalism. Science journalism was badly hit. So the conference was very attractive to people who are interested in how to fix science journalism or how to communicate science in the lack of science journalism. So this year, that was kind of the group that, I wouldn't say dominated, but it was numerically very, very strong. Who knows what next year is going to bring? We'll see. Depends on developments in the broader society and in science. But we want to grow all the groups, people who are interested in education, people who are interested in math, people who are interested in skepticism. So each group hopefully will organically grow as the conference itself grows. So the diversity of interest remains as a whole.
Now we have, hopefully you can answer this quickly because we are almost out of time, but we have a chat room question from Kylie Sturgis.
You've been tweeting recently about science blogging, the pros and cons, with a lot of new research. What is the overall summary of how it is going?
Whoa, really I have question. To do that in a minute. I was just in San Diego at an AES conference talking about that for 20 minutes and had to be cut off. So blogging is now just one of the pieces, one of the platforms that everybody who's communicating science or even doing science has to do. Communicating science after the research is done is part of the scientific method. You get the idea, you test the hypothesis, and then you communicate it. Blogging is just one of the tools that everybody has to use, from, you know, making your own images, making your videos, making your audio podcasts, taking your own photographs, and making your own graphs, using Twitter, and publishing in newspapers and magazines, and writing books. Everybody has to do everything. So blog is just one of the many platforms that everybody involved in science and science communication, which is part of science, needs to be familiar with. It needs to become comfortable in using.
It was far less than 20 minutes, sir.
Was it fast enough? Good. I tried to summarize it really, really quickly.
And we are completely out of time. So thank you very much, Bora, for being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for coming to Science Online and seeing it for yourself. And
absolutely.
I hope you'll be back next January again.
Oh, absolutely. This is definitely a yearly conference for me.
And bring a lot of skeptics with you.
Oh, I will. Where can people find your website?
ScienceOnline2010.com. That is for the last one. We're actually in the process of building kind of an archival website, which is going to contain the wikis of all the conferences so far and all the information about the past conferences and future conferences all in one place. It's kind of hard to find the right find.
Perfect. And so you can find Bora where he said he would be. And you can find us at skepticallyspeaking.com, as well as links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. And we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon men. understanding mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.